Blog Talk Radio.
Friends to Blog Talk Radio and a Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends, Chuck Thurston and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, Paula. Good morning, Chuck.
Yeah, I should say my dear friends and co-hosts. Comrades,
we actually do that, too. Yeah.
In the journey here. So so good to spend the last day of 2022 with you guys for a couple of hours. How wonderful is that? Miss our buddy Marvin. He's got family engagements, I think, probably today.
Yeah, probably.
I
didn't hear for sure, but we wish him good family time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed.
Which is one of the best things that happens to us on this world, if you ask me. Good family time, you know. And we actually get to have that with each other, too. You know, one of the great things about, and we've talked about this before, but being a student of the Urantia book is you immediately start to feel like the universe is your family. And the people on this planet for sure are your family.
Yeah.
And it takes away barriers to getting to know people. You know, you're much more willing to open your heart and open yourself up to even total strangers. And Jesus said what a joy it is to meet a new brother or sister, you know. All of a sudden nothing I've ever encountered made me understand more than the Urantia book how much we really are one family of a divine creator. So that's pretty amazing when you think about it. And you realize all the ramifications of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It,
so happy New Year, brothers.
Better to realize all of that sooner rather than later, I say.
Yes.
Because
well, we can make the world a better place.
Having to adjust to that, you know, later in life. And can you imagine if you've never adjusted it to it in life and you somehow still make it, you know, to Mansonia with that kind of attitude, what an adjustment that is. My goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how difficult that would be. There's so many things. That's why life is designed to get us to try to learn as much as we can of those kinds of essentials, and the true essentials or relationship essentials. And we don't all get them all. We don't all do perfectly. And we definitely cause problems and friction on the way up as we learn, some more than others. But by the time we get to a certain place, life is constructed, then we ought to truly understand that we're all in this together, that there is really no, we're absolutely separate individuals, and we are absolutely connected individuals as well.
Yeah.
And designed to function together and designed to function uniquely. And this is the hard thing to get one's mind around, is that it's neither a hive nor is it a free-for-all. And how do you balance between responsible social spiritual interaction and development of your creative individuality.
Consciousness comes to mind.
and an eternity perspective, too. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when I first was reading the Rancho book, starting to get an idea of what it was saying, one of the first things I realized is that the people I know in this life, friends, family, you know, people that I know well, people I know casually, but especially the people I know well, it's a beginning of an eternal association. I mean, these relationships from this life are going to carry over into eternity. So I started looking at people a little differently with that in mind, you know, kind of reframes our relationships, knowing that they're going to truly unfold in eternity. They'll have value in eternity also. You know, it's not as if all is lost when we die, and it's all erased. I mean, clearly, we go on, continue to grow and learn, but we also continue to grow and learn in our relationships, some of which begin during this life. So anyway, just in response to what you're saying, it kind of put a new value for me on relationships. It was also just kind of a, whoa, wait a second. You know, it was one of those startling realizations, you might say. So many of which come from studying the Rancho book. But that was the idea that relationships from this life endure potentially even into eternity. And so you start thinking about, well, what does it be like? What would it be like to know my mom, you know, in like 2 million years or something? You know. Or looking forward to, you know, like thinking of my parents, you know, looking forward to seeing them in the next life, seeing how they've grown and developed. Maybe assuming they're already there, maybe they're not, I don't know. But if they are, then they're going to have grown a lot by the time I show up, you know, in the next world and look them up, as they say we have the opportunity to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be something.
That'll be fun.
Well, that's what's so comforting, right? Isn't that comforting to know that the work that you feel like, you know, you have a lot of loose ends and you never had any closure around that, or whatever it is,
yeah,
you know, that you will have that closure in the future, and that, you know, it goes on. All the joy, the you know, magic of relationship, the beauty of relationship, also the difficulty of it, I think. Maybe it won't be as complicated up there. They'll help us sort it all out, and it'll seem maybe many of the things that seem so dire down here won't seem troublesome up there at all. You know, they'll seem trite and just trifles, you know. But you know, all of it will get sorted out. It's like Jesus, you know, he said at one point, the mistakes you fail to forget in time will be forgotten in eternity. And I think about that. I think, okay, you mean I might be having to carry some of this stuff for a long, long time. But I guess that's, you know, it's relative to your abilities and your attitude. So I'm sure all of that will improve going forward. We, you know, before we came on the air, friends, I mentioned that, you know, because we're just thinking about time. We're coming to the end of the year. You know, we're going to be studying about angels here. And Andre, your quote or your comment was so meaningful because, you know, we are all individuals, and yet we are being upheld and protected by this great collective mind, this beautiful spiritual mind, and all of these amazing creatures, these angels and seraphim and or cherubim and sanabim and, you know, these gifts of the Mother Spirit that hold us all in one field, one mind.
Yeah.
And their approach is, you know, is unique but identical. And that's what we're striving to find. We're striving to find our own identity and our own uniqueness and yet honor that in everyone else. But also realize that spiritually we are all the same. The spirit substance that is in each of us is identical. And that is our commonality right there. That's what makes us siblings. And so we can, you know, we all want to be unique individuals, you know. That's part of the American life, actually, in the American way, to be rugged individuals, right? To have, you know, to be self-reliant and independent. And that's good. But it's also important to realize that we're all connected. And what we do as rugged individuals affects many around us in many ways. And so, you know, and also they also want to be appreciated for who they are and their own individualism. It's challenging. But, you know, I believe it's really doable. Because it comes from an attitude of loving who people are, just allowing them to be who they are and loving them for who they are. So, it's but I made the comment early on that, but right before we went on the show, that it occurred to me some years ago that every little increment of time is unique in infinity and will never happen again. This moment is fleeting. This day, December the 31st, 2022, will never happen again in all eternity. A unique day. And we get to decide how we're going to spend it. You know?
Try to make the most of it.
Yeah. And I'm struck by a blessing that David Kenner sent out to some friends today. I don't know if you guys saw it, but he says, "Dear friends, may the Spirit of Truth bestowed upon humanity on the day of Pentecost, your guiding light in 2023, a holy, happy, healthy, wealthy, and blessed new year to all. I'm determined to have our introductory film finished by the end of 2023. A quote which seems endlessly to turn over in my mind is a comment made about Jesus in paper 134.97. Though he wasted little time upon trifles, he was a painstaking workman when it came to the essentials of any given undertaking." And then David goes on to say, "Eschew the trifles. Embrace the essentials. Keep going with all your efforts to further the revelation and the cause of the kingdom. Take heart in the realization that, quote, perfection is our eternal goal, not our origin. With love and appreciation, David Cantor, Urantia Book Films. So we know David's working on a monumental introduction to the Urantia Book, and he spent, what, gosh, 7 years on it so far. He's saying he'll have it done at the end of 2023. That'll be amazing.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
something that our local Urantia Society, the Rocky Mountain Spiritual Fellowship, which is a member of the Urantia Book Fellowship, has been dedicated and devoted to helping him achieve that. So... that'll be a great thing. I'm very much looking forward to seeing it. But I just, that's what got me thinking about time, you guys, just so you know, is a great, great opportunity at the end of the year, you know, at the end of this particular year, 2022. He wasted little time upon trifles. That's a good goal for 2023.
Does that mean I have to give up Wordle?
Wordle. Boy, Glenn would be really disappointed if he had to give up Wordle because that's something
too.
He looks forward to. Things that make him think. So anyway, if there's, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. No, well, the curated list only goes for about 5.5 years anyway, so. They have to repeat it or do something different. But anyway, that's, your earlier point is more important. You know, what does that mean, you know, to not spend your time on trifles? What were the trifles? And what's important? I remember when I went, there was a retreat. It's closed now, unfortunately. It was run by the Carmelite nuns in Crestone, Colorado. Was called Nada Hermitage. And Nada in Spanish means nothing. I don't know that it was named after that, but it was a wonderful hermitage. It was, you know, it was a good place to get away. And I don't know whether just too many were retiring and they just didn't have the means of upkeep. But what I do remember is that if you would go and drive in, there was a sign posted prominently on the driveway. Two simple words, no fuss. No fuss. And it was very interesting reflecting on those words that was somehow encapsulating a big part of the outworking of the religious philosophy that was in operation there. And that to me is brought about as well by remembering that the master did not spend time on trifles.
Well, I found that that quote I was thinking about, it sort of pertains to this. This is where they're talking about time in relation to maturity. And they say that this is in paper 118. They say to become mature is to live more intensely in the present. At the same time, escaping the limitations of the present. The plans of maturity founded on past experience are coming into being in the present in such manner as to enhance the values of the future. So it occurs to me that maybe trifles would be something that, things that don't enhance the values of the future. You know, they're not part of the plan of maturity, you know, just thinking about Jesus and the way he would work and the quality of his work. You know, what they say he was painstaking about the important stuff. And that's probably the kind of, maybe the kind of intensity they're referring to here. You know, to live more intensely in the present while at the same time escaping the limitations of the present. So I can think of a lot of limitations to the present, you know, like distractions and pain that we experience, you know, oftentimes. You know, living with pain is a very difficult thing. It's very distracting. You know, it takes our mind away from the focus on the present. So things like that. We grow in our ability to cope with all kinds of things that pull us away from that intense engagement with the present. Anyway, it's kind of fascinating to think about.
I think one of the
how that develops over time. I mean, the fact that they associate it with maturity suggests that a lot of experience goes into our development of, you know, our capacity just to even cope with being on this planet and living this life, you know, and it's probably has a lot to do with setting aside the trifles as distracting or desirable as they may be sometimes. I don't know. It's always there's always a real time judgment call going on. And that's, you know, that's our responsibility to make those kinds of decisions of how we focus our attention. You know, time and attention are closely related. His attention functions in time, but it's always, you know, it's always now. So,
right.
Hopefully, how we manage that. Yeah.
One of the things that I think is a challenge is you know, the trauma, the pain. You mentioned pain. We do experience pain in this life, and it is very real, and brutally real at times. And it is not only distracting, but traumatizing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges I think we have, being from this particular planet and having to live down here, having to do all the things we've been talking about, make the most of our time, you know, contribute something lasting, something of value, something that will, you know, because we're, speaking of time, we're here for just a short while, really. And lately I've been thinking a lot about what it would be like in the ages of light and life, where we've eradicated diseases and a lot of the things that trip us up and make us fall into, you know, into these traps that we fall into, or that those we love fall into, right, which is equally painful. As it happening to yourself, and I think what will it be like? What would it be like for me right now, if I could talk to my grandma, and her mom, and my grandpa and his father, if I had access to them right now, in this moment, because they were all still here, you know. That fills me with wonder. That, you know, the fact that we start to get so disabled as we get older, and we don't even get that old compared to life on a normal world, or life on a world that is heading for light and life, or in light and life. 60 something wouldn't be that would. Still be a spring chicken in many ways. And what with if you had the maturity and the mobility and health and mental acumen and all of those things that, you know, you could still contribute so much. And you could contribute so much, not only to your progeny, but to your, you know, your children, your grandchildren, your grandchildren's children. You would be such a vital contributor to all of that. But one of the challenges is we do have so little time and we're gone. And 100 years from now, nobody, very few people will even know we were ever here. You know, you realize you're standing on the shoulders of your ancestors, but you don't know them. And, you know, they can't benefit you with their wisdom, the wisdom that they've earned. So that's just an interesting thing about, you know, time and some of the challenges we have. And,
mm-hmm. Well, in the next
and
book,
trauma. Trauma gets us stuck. That's the other thing. It gets us stuck in a moment of time. It can get us completely stuck in a moment of time. And it's hard. It can be very hard to get out of that moment. And that can go on for years, as we know, grieving a moment of time.
Well,
where something
even,
traumatic
it's even
happens.
More difficult when you consider that how many people, especially in say, more affluent culture these days, are becoming more and more isolated. You know, the thing that gets us unstuck is having valuable and important relationships that where people know us and love us
and support us
and know, get to know us and get to know how we you know, can move out of things or want us to move out of things or help us. And it's very, very difficult when people become more and more isolated. It's such a problem that they have a minister of loneliness now in Britain. I mean, I'm not kidding. They have a ministry of loneliness that is now part of the cabinet, part of the departmental structure of Britain. And that says something about our cultures, you know, specifically their culture. But we're not above that. There are plenty of people in North American culture, whether you look on either side of the border, that suffer from loneliness. And that's something that doesn't tend to happen in the same way in, say, less developed cultures. Because in those so-called less developed cultures, the family is still all important. You know, I have some friends right now. They are going through their brother and son, respectively, is in the hospital with a respiratory condition that was looking very dire in the Philippines. They're all around him. You know, they're all there supporting him. And it's not that we don't have people doing that here, but goodness gracious. There are plenty of people, if you've ever been to the hospital visiting friends in adjoining rooms who are receiving no visitors. Plenty of people that are there essentially completely alone. And one of the things, and maybe that would segue us to our reading here, is we realize here in this revelation that with the angelic ministry of the seraphim, the cherubim, the sanubim, we're never alone. We're never truly alone. Even though we can't necessarily always feel their presence, we can't, and I'm not suggesting that one ought to be able to feel their presence, but just knowing that can be a help. Just faithfully going through life and realizing, okay, even though this feels like I'm completely isolated, I am not alone. There are those that are looking out for me for my highest interests, for my best interests, and they are making sure that I have experiences that will move me closer to God. That's hard to realize in every moment when it seems like there's an experience that has nothing to do with God. But I was reminded the other day in that one statement, the adjuster would also like to remind us of those kinds of things, and where he says, you know, the subject of my solicitous devotion, without over chastisement, I'm paraphrasing loosely right now, because I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's out of paper 110, that he more faithfully, you know, endure the tasks of my emplacement. You know, the adjusters and the seraphim are working hand in hand. Inexplicably, they say they don't know how that harmony of cooperation happens, because the seraphim are not talking to the thought adjuster, and the thought adjuster is not talking to the seraphim. But somehow there is a coordination that is happening there. And that's a fascinating thing to think about. And maybe we could read a section and discuss more on the other side, since we've got half an hour.
Yeah, I'm all for that. And just, what you said is so true, Andre, and maybe that's the key. The key is loneliness and isolation, and I think it drives people to do things they wouldn't normally do, and understanding that we're never alone and that we are beloved and that nobody is disposable or expendable. Not to God.
You know, they speak many times about talking about Jesus, about his unbroken communion with God. And then there's this reference I found sort of recently where they say that self-consciousness is in essence a communal consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's in paper 16. Self-consciousness is in essence a communal consciousness. God and man, Father and Son, Creator and creature. And human self-consciousness, well, then they go on to talk about it. But that idea that even when I'm humanly by myself, my consciousness of myself, it is a communal consciousness. It's like a community of beings and influences, you know, primary in that is our relationship to God, who's always with us. So I think that's why they put so much importance on that idea of unbroken communion. And that's something we can just kind of gradually develop over time. It's just always remember, God's with me all the time. And, you know, give a little wink and a nod once in a while just to acknowledge that reality. And then it kind of fills your whole being with a wonderful good feeling to remember that.
Take it one step farther and thank him for being there. I can't tell you how many.
That's all part of it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for being there with me. I feel you. Mm-hmm. I feel you there.
And there's an immediacy there, too, in terms of needing to talk things over sometimes. You just flip right into it because it's always kind of working.
He's always on.
He's always on.
Yeah.
But anyway, that idea that my self-consciousness is a communal consciousness kind of cracked me up when I first read it. But at the same time, I really appreciate the reality of that because it goes a long way toward mitigating that loneliness potential that we all have and feel at times. And when you feel your communal relationship with God as really part of the essence of yourself, then you have a lot more interest in breaking out of that loneliness. You know, getting out, seeing people, doing something, you know, because it stimulates the curiosity, you know, the desire to serve instead of just being alone and feeling sorry for myself, you know. You get a new kind of mobilization of your soul where you want to do something just interesting and meaningful and will actually make things better and contribute to the, you know, the well-being of everyone. So.
And that works, doesn't it? That works so well when you just get out of yourself and put yourself out to serve others. Boy,
right? Yeah,
what an antidote misery.
These other sections, speaking of seraphim, you know, in other sections of the book, they talk about, you know, how the seraphim will teach us in the next world. You know, like the
ministering reserves.
Right, and the teachers on the mansion worlds are going to be instructed by seraphim to a large degree. So that's going to be a fascinating thing, you know, like with our
deserted cherubim
and
sanubim.
Absolutely. Yeah, the mansion world teachers, for sure.
Yeah.
But, like, there's this group that includes the mind planners and the Maracha counselors. That we'll be associating with, so.
Well, shall we?
Well, that's a great, that's a great segue.
Yeah, let's do.
So, Chuck, do you want to read section 6?
Let's see. And this is paper,
I can too.
Paper 38? No, I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Yeah,
38. I knew the thing. Oh, it is 38. Okay.
Yeah.
I was looking at different things here. Section 6, seraphic organization, right? Okay.
Yeah,
we were just reading last time, I guess, about seraphic training, which is interesting that they go through so much training to finally arrive at the point where they have the, you know, the privilege to associate with us as guardians. That's a prized assignment. Anyway, so seraphic organization, this is a short little section, only 3 paragraphs. After the second millennium of sojourn at seraphic headquarters, the seraphim are organized into groups of 12, 12 pairs, 24 seraphim. And 12 such groups constitute a company, 144 pairs, 288 seraphim, which is commanded by a leader. 12 companies under a commander constitute a battalion, 1,728 pairs, or 3,456 seraphim, and 12 battalions under a director equal a seraphic unit, 20,736 pairs, or 41,472 individuals, while 12 units subject to the command of a supervisor constitute a legion. So we talk about legions of angels, constitute a legion numbering 248,832 pairs, or 497,664 individuals. Jesus alluded to such a group of angels that night in the Garden of Gethsemane when he said, "I can even now ask my Father, and he will presently give me more than 12 legions of angels." 12 legions of angels comprise a host numbering 2,985,984 pairs, or 5,971,968 individuals, and 12 such hosts. Oh my God! And 12 such hosts, which would be 35,831,808 pairs, or 71,663,616 individuals, make up the largest operating organization of seraphim, an angelic army. Wow. A seraphic host is commanded by an archangel or by some other personality of coordinate status, while the angelic armies are directed by the brilliant evening stars or by other intermediate lieutenants of Gabriel. And Gabriel is the, quote, supreme commander of the armies of heaven, unquote, the chief executive of the sovereign of Nebadon, quote, the Lord God of hosts. Oh, so maybe that's where that comes from. Though serving under the direct supervision of the infinite spirit, as personalized on Salvington, that would be the local universe mother spirit, of course. Interesting how they put that. Though serving under the direct supervision of the infinite spirit as personalized on Salvington, since the bestowal of Michael on Urantia, seraphim and all other universe orders have become subject to the sovereignty of the Master Son. Even when Michael was born in the flesh on Urantia, there issued the super universe broadcast to all Nebadon, which proclaimed, quote, "And let all the angels worship him," unquote. All ranks of angels are subject to his sovereignty. They are a part of that group which has been denominated, quote, his mighty angels.
Wow. So for a short section, that is really intriguing.
Yeah.
A lot of
well, they know that,
there.
That if they're going to deal with numbers, they better keep it short for most of us, you know.
Sorry that you got to read that one.
most people okay. like to glaze over with the numbers. But again, the fascinating thing here is their use of the number 12 how significant that is. That, you know,
these are all powers of 12, right?
Yeah, they're all powers of 12, right. So that last one is essentially 2 times 12 to the 7th power to get your 71,663,616 individuals. And it's equally significant, the 2 in there, the idea that they're all paired. There is not one without another that is complemental in some way. They function in complementary pairs in general. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, too, the pattern with Jesus of having 12 apostles, but he only selected 6 of them. And then, if I'm remembering this correctly, he allowed the first 6 that he chose to choose 6 more.
That's what he did.
Interestingly, a kind of a similar pattern, implying that there's some significance to 12 with regard to organization. I'm not sure.
Well, it makes up some of the different mind types. You know, when they talk about on your rancher there being 4 and 20 in mind types, that, of course, is 2 times 12. And there seem to be complemental mind types that function together. I've often speculated about this, and I won't go down a rabbit hole with this. We can do that some other time when we're talking about mind, but it really does harken back. There's an interesting aspect or similarity when you start looking at the idea of any kind of binary factors of mindedness that you could talk about with regard to, you know, energizing or the kind of data that people are interested in or the kind of orientation to awareness that people have. And so Jung was one of the first to, you know, try to talk about this, and he talked about 3 factors primarily, and that was that there were extroverts and introverts, people that energized with others and others that energized by themselves was the main aspect of it. It isn't, you know, that an introvert is always staying by themselves. Some of the best actors are introverts, good character actors. So it doesn't have anything to do with being alone. It has to do with how you energize. Your output may be among a lot of different people, but the key aspect of an introvert is, in general, they need to hunker down by themselves to energize, whereas an extrovert tends to need to be with others to energize and tends to deplete when by themselves too often. And we have about a 3-to-1 ratio with people, you know, that are that way, extrovert to introvert, which is why introverts, you know, feel a little more isolated as well. You know, they prefer to go off by themselves. Well, anyway, I am going down a rabbit hole now, aren't I? So
you're making me perk, Andre. So I just want to add, because I am married to a classic introvert, and I am pretty much a classic extrovert, and and I, for whatever reason in my life, I have always been attracted to introverts. And I have always wanted to open up to them and allow them to be who they are with me. And I've always found that getting to know them is so worth doing. you know, drawing them out, let's say, just being, you know, making a place where they feel safe and then they can be themselves. And they show you the most wonderful things about themselves. And so it's not that they really want to be alone, I have found. It's that they're, you know, they're not as comfortable in groups as I am, which is fine. But it's interesting to me with my own marriage, which is so wonderful and rewarding to me, that, you know, Glenn and I will go to a party, and he'll kind of get all quiet and not say much. But then when we come home and it's just the two of us, he opens up to me, and he is, you know, he's my muse. And he's so funny and so, you know, interesting and wonderful. And so it's just an interest to me that, you know, introverts don't necessarily want to be known by everybody, but they do want to be known by somebody who understands them. And it's very rewarding to them to have that. And that's to your point about isolation. You know, introverts maybe tend to isolate more than others, but it should behoove us extroverts to try and draw them out a little bit and spend time with them and let them know that they are, you know, beloved and interesting and that we care, because then they open up. And I also find as life goes on that, you know, whatever it is, whatever our, you know, propensity is, I tend to need to withdraw more and he tends to need to open up to others more. And that seems to be a natural evolution for both of us, you know. So it's just interesting how that works. But it is a great compliment, because oftentimes, you know, and I always think of it as just, you know, this, speaking of angels coming in pairs, one is aggressive and the other retiring. And I think that is a natural pairing that makes a good relationship. I think it's just a great pairing. And it's a very much of a compliment. One is a ground, the other's alive, you know, and they work together. They make up for what the other lacks. And it really is a beautiful thing. So you can see how these angels, they need each other. And they appreciate, there's no barrier to it. They just appreciate their compliment and what that adds to them. And I wanted to read that. So thanks for bringing that up, Andre. I mean, it's a nice point of reflection for me, introverts and extroverts. And I've had a lot of wonderful introverted friends. And they don't necessarily want to be alone. They may take in energy when they are alone, but they do need relationship as much as anybody. They just aren't comfortable in groups, is what I've found about them. But here's that quote for that Jesus was referring to, that the section Chuck just read. This is from paper 183. Section 3, paragraph 7, and of course they're in the Garden of Gethsemane and the soldiers have come. And so I'll just read the quote. Jesus was ready to go back to Jerusalem with the guards, and the captain of the soldiers was altogether willing to allow the three apostles and their associates to go their way in peace. Before they were able to get started, as Jesus stood there awaiting the captain's orders, one Malchus, the Syrian bodyguard of the high priest, stepped up to Jesus and made ready to bind his hands behind his back, although the Roman captain had not directed that Jesus should be thus bound. Peter and his associates saw their master being subjected to this indignity and were no longer able to restrain themselves. Peter drew his sword and with the others rushed forward to smite Malchus. But before the soldiers could come to the defense of the high priest's servant, Jesus raised a forbidding hand to Peter and, speaking sternly, said, "Peter, put up your sword. They who take the sword shall perish by the sword. They not understand that it is the Father's will that I drink this cup? And do you not further know that I could even now command more than 12 legions of angels and their associates who would deliver me from the hands of these few men? You know, I just love that section because to me it speaks of the faith that we don't have, you know, that we don't understand how protected we really are and how beloved we really are. And the resources that are available to us. Because he's got our back, right? And he was not afraid in that moment. He knew what he could do. It was the Father's will that this happened. So often we fight against something that it's pointless to fight against. If it were to be another way, it would be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah, nice taking us back to that reference of 12 legions of angels and what the actual context was for it.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you for bringing us there.
Mm-hmm. There's another instance of this organization by 12, and that would be the Council of 24, which is, of course, 12 times 2.
Right.
Ah, good point.
So, yeah.
So, it's, I don't want to take
there's a balance.
It's really about trying to get to mindedness. It's really trying to have diversity. It's really about there's a certain optimal diversity in that kind of grouping that doesn't duplicate itself. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about
pairs,
that kind of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can have pairs, you can have triads, you can have groups of four, all subdivisions out of 12. Which creates a lot of potential for variety within social organizations.
It does.
I just want to point out, I don't want to take us down a rabbit hole, but in terms of numbers and the way they manifest, there's three or four different patterns that become evident through your answer book, and one of them is the 1-3-7 pattern, from the unity to the Trinity to the seven, super universes, seven master spirits. And that seems to be a pattern of creation. Unfolding of creation seems to happen along the 1-3-7 sequence. Whereas growth, if you look at growth of plants and animals in our body, it's all according to Fibonacci series. So we see the golden mean being expressed all the time in patterns of growth. But then when you look at structure, like even the structure of our body, that gets us into the decimal realm, where we find symmetry, like we have five fingers, but they're on two different hands. They're symmetrically arranged, on opposite sides of our body.
With opposable thumb.
Right. But there's a symmetry to the physical structure, and that tends to be governed by the decimal, decimal numbers. And then finally, there's the what we're just thinking about, which is more like social organization that seems to be manifest along patterns of 12. And we've looked at, three instances of that, the angelic organization, Jesus' apostles, the Council of 24, and there's probably many others.
Right.
So anyway, just to throw that in, that there are these different, patterns of unfolding, patterns of association, patterns of manifestation.
They're
all
important
these kind
to
of
pay
four,
attention to.
Into these four different categories.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's so?
That's why they're presenting them to us. They're wanting to give us really a sense of how organized things are, and how they're using clearly a military analogy here for of all things angels, for spiritual beings.
Right.
Now talk about juxtaposing two things that the human mind would not normally put together in that way. they're trying to give us a sense of what? Of the idea that there is both organization, there is command, but this is not for war. This is not for war. This is for the promulgation of progress and love and peace in an unusual, you know, and pick your progressive quality that you want to be thinking about. This is what's being performed by this army, or literally armies of individuals. And remember, you know, if there's 71 million individuals making up an army, and you remember in paper 114, Seraphic Planetary Government, where the first thing they do is they give us the planetary roll call, right? Is that there were 1,194,693,600 individual angels, 200 seraphic hosts were at that time taken care of, you know, what needed to happen on Urantia. They're not differentiating whether they are guardian seraphim or what. I mean, guardian seraphim would only be a fraction of that, what they were doing. But the idea, the thing to remember at that time, the population of the world had just about, just past 2 billion individuals. I think the population in 1934, I once researched, was not even, was it two, it was somewhere between 2 and 2.3 billion people. We, of course, are either on the threshold or have just passed 8 billion, depending on what census you want to pay attention to. But we're right there. 8 billion is a good number. It's not clear how many angels would be serving now. Would it be four times as many for four times as many people? Or would it be just twice as many or not even twice as many because of the coordination of what they're able to do with, you know, angels and the cherubim and everybody else and how coordinated they are? That's the key here. That beings that are functioning above a human kind of spirituality have much greater ability for coordinating and cooperating naturally, you know, without antagonisms. They're not looking to, you know, well, what's in it for me? Can you imagine a creation that, you know, being supervised by what's in it for me types? You know, we wouldn't have the kinds of experiences that I hear your Urantia book readers report about, unusual coordination of circumstances that furthered them along in their path some way. And I'm not talking about just saving people in accidents or that kind of thing. I'm just, you know, you think about all the different junctures in your life that were fortuitous, that you had to be open to in order for you to get from where you are today. And you might not see it in any one year. And believe me, I'm speaking very positively about this, but when I'm isolated, I drink deeply of the cup of, oh, really? Oh, really? I have to go through this now? But it's in fellowship. It's in fellowship that we can realize that we're all in this together and that there's something good coming about, that we're all being led forward, and both by our angels and our adjusters. So here they are. There's that many. You know, there might be 2 billion angels on this world, maybe 3, maybe 4, I don't know. But that was giving us a marker as well, the 200 seraphic hosts assigned to your rancho. And notice it was assigning those entire units as well. That, in other words, they don't dribble them out. Okay, there's a few more mortals now, so we'll send a few more seraphim. That's not how they do it. They assign, you know, whole companies and hosts and however they do that. It's all under a certain organization. There's a plan for the use of all these individuals. And that's very, very hard for us to get our minds around because we can't even imagine really what they're all fully doing. And that's going to be one of the fascinating aspects of, say, the next few lives that we go through. And as we begin to make our first forays to, and you know, visiting other planets, and we experience seraphic ministry from the other side, and we say, oh, oh, that's what they're doing. Interesting. So,
you know,
I'll stop.
We wonder what... why sometimes they give us, and I love hearing you speak about it, Andre, because the numbers speak to you. And our dear friend Michelle Clemish always used to tell me, numbers tell a story. They do.
Mm-hmm.
Having been a bookkeeper, having kept books all these years, I know numbers tell a story. And if you're looking for the story they tell, they do tell a story. And to mm-hmm. me, the story this tells me, and what you just mentioned, the comment you just made tells me what Jesus reiterated and what the Arantia book reiterates many times: anxiety must be abandoned. Be anxious about. Be worried about. Put up your sword, Peter. Come on. You know, you don't have to fight against anything or be against. You just have to understand the resources you have and how to tap into that and use that. You can join this army. You can enlist. Mm-hmm. They are counting on you. You're their boots on the ground. And to the degree that they can count on you to lend a hand to a struggling mortal, an ear or a heart, a hug, a kind word, encouragement, you know, all of the heroic stories we are hearing coming out of Buffalo, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And then we realize that it's like Jesus said, the real things, it's like Jesus said to Fortune on the Hillside, the real things of the universe are on your side. You got it mm-hmm. made, kids. You're going to be fine. Look, and you know, your comment about they're using military terms, that struck me when Chuck read it. But it's mm-hmm. about a high degree of organization. And the other thing, as you were talking, I thought of was, yes, pairs. You know, we could utilize pairs much more often than we do. Jesus did that. He never sent them out alone. We could utilize the buddy system, which is essentially what it is, you know, that we go out together.
I love that, the buddy system, yeah. I love
yeah.
it.
And, well, marriage is intended to be that.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Or at least one.
And when we pick a leader, we could insist that they have a buddy, right? I mean, we could get into the mode of, you know, of choosing two and not just one. Male and female complement to each other, which would definitely, I think, accomplish more. And they don't necessarily have to be married. I mean, but just the idea and the fellowship has tossed this around many times rather than having a president have co-presidents, a male and a female, you know. So I'm intrigued by this idea. I really am, this that they always go in pairs. They complement mm-hmm. each other. And not only – and there's so many practical reasons for that, so many. you can see where they keep each other in check. You know, they help each other. They're there to support each other. They love each other.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the bond that they have with each other. How precious that is. And if we go all the way to paradise with our guardians, they'll still be together. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a feature of life in future ages? I forget where that comes up. But there is mention in the Urantia book about positions even within government being held by male-female pairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's enlightened life. Enlightened life
does make its appearance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably on some worlds before that, but what to me, some of what that also speaks to is the degree of the necessity of adequate spiritualization in order for that to be accomplished. Because even in good marriages, you know, the antagonism that can happen in difference of opinion, you know, for two individuals, two intelligent people, two people that may be even very forward-looking and progressive, it's not a given that, you know, both people are going to function in such a way together that they're going to be very cooperative. So the reason that we don't have pairs functioning is because of how often those things would break apart. And how important it is at earlier stages to invest authority in an individual. I mean, in the prior tribal stages, even more so. But, as they indicate, that the further on you get along, the more important it is that you do have at all stages, whether it be governmentally, educationally, there's a value to having a pair, and specifically a pair of complements. Let's put it that way. You know, functioning together.
Well, look at the local universe. You know, with Michael and the Mother Spirit.
Yeah.
Profound example. Exactly that.
I want to read a couple comments from the board because this is so great. Perry said, "All life flourishes empowered by loving partnership." And then Pam pointed out that we are missing out with the absence of our Adam and Eve. Certainly that sublime pair working together would have made such a difference to all of us in our whole perceptions about what can be accomplished in a loving partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And, and those things, I guess, you know, that's our challenges on this world, to create those things, to create those partnerships, and even teach our children, especially, how to pick a partner, you know, that is based on these principles of cooperation and love and what they can achieve together and not just about how attracted they are to each other, you know?
Right.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Right.
That's a big one. There's so little education in that area, you know. There's no marriage training, or even like you're saying, the choice of a mate comes before that. That's amazing.
What could be more important, really, when you think about it? I mean, for us to teach our children is how to pick the person they're going to give their life to and work with day in and day out to do these most important things. Their legacy, their children, and, you know.
We go through a lot of
it's pretty special
on this world.
Yeah.
You know, hence the high divorce rates. And a lot of that's just trial and error. Okay, well, I thought it would work, but oops. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
I
it's
tried
not
you
only
on,
just
it didn't
trial
fit.
And error. There's, there's unfortunately,
learning.
There's a lot of, well, there's a lot of learning. There's a lot of subconscious living out of various things that you've seen in your own family life that were dysfunctional that you are trying to resolve and live out yourself. There's the one a wonderful ray of hope in some of that is that some marriages are so spectacularly bad that they function as great counterexamples of what not to do. And so the kids are able to avoid certain things, just in avoiding certain things are able to pick good partners. And it's not universal, and it's not, it doesn't happen necessarily. Am I speaking from experience? Oh, anyway.
Well, you know, I mean, and it's the beauty of a good partnership then is it stands as an example for everybody too, just like a bad partnership can too. And in some instances, children are very observant. You know, they don't have a voice in this world much, but they are very observant. And we can learn a lot from them because they do watch what we do. And they do learn from our mistakes. Oftentimes, they learn from our mistakes. Mm-hmm. Thank God, right? And in a way, that's
right.
Evolution, you know? So.
You know, it's interesting. I'd like to pull you three, all of us here. I can say one good thing that I didn't do, you know, with my children, and to her credit, her mother, their mother didn't do that either. They did not interfere in their relationship choices, and so they got to learn, you know, on their own from their relationship choices, and there wasn't over. I mean. Had anybody come to me, nobody did. Had anybody come to me and asked me, well, I would have listened and perhaps made a comment or two or whatever, but I really didn't have the desire to manage that. And what I noticed, what was always astounding to me, is how different a partner choice they were making than I would have imagined they would have made.
Huh.
You know, there was no way for me to predict what my children would do in terms of any of their kinds of relationship choices. You know, there's no A is to B, B is to C kind of thing. It was more like down in the XYZ category. It was like way down the line and, you know, I'm sure much better than anything I could have suggested. Anyway, but that's what's very, very interesting to observe. And when I think of, you know, I don't know about all of your other children, Paul, but when I think of May and her choice, you know, and I think of what a lovely relationship that is. And when I think of, you know, Angie and her choice of partner and what a wonderful relationship that appears to be, you know, I think of the interesting influence of how our kids grow up and what they're able to do. And it doesn't work perfectly. I've got a daughter that's just gone through the end of a bad relationship that she didn't know was entirely bad while she was in it. I won't say any more than that. But, you know, the idea is, though, her attitude toward it is so positive. You know, she has learned from it. And we'll see what happens, you know, with the next relationship and how that happens. But I don't know, what are your comments in terms of what you saw and what would be interesting that way? I mean, I know we're a little bit off from angels, but not really, because what we're talking about is how do we get to that state. How do we get that, to that state of being able to function in a pair the way,
as partners,
because of inherent spirituality just slightly above ours, they seem to be able to do without having to work through anything other than their initial 5,000 years of seraphic training and 5,000 years of observation.
Right.
You know, so, okay, so they had 10,000 years of you know, training before they had to hunker down and start to make selection about what they would do. for work. But still, they are created in pairs. They function more naturally that way than we do. What can we learn from that in order to function better?
Pam on this.
Said, yeah, they don't have the sex urge. You're right, Pam.
You and I saw that at the same time. That's funny.
Oh,
the reaction. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, yeah, we our task is much more complicated, actually. But, you know, I think that we, perhaps what the lesson is we start teaching children sooner about relationships and start engaging and learning those lessons ourselves sooner, you know, and just being more serious about that, especially at childbearing age. And, you know, what's kind of troublesome to me is young people who seem to have no inclination to get married and have children anymore. That concerns me, you know, because
yeah,
it was so built into us. It was so built in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody. I didn't know anybody that didn't want to get married and have children and have a family in my generation.
Yeah.
Very, very few people. But it seems to be getting more and more, and I worry about that because of isolation. You know, I have friends who are in their 30s, never been married, and 40s even.
Yeah.
Never been married,
mm-hmm.
never taken that step, maybe
mm-hmm.
because they didn't want to or maybe because it just didn't work out. They did want to, but the person
well,
that they chose, whatever, for whatever reason, just didn't, you know, end up working out. But it's still concerning to me, and it seems like, to me almost, like time is working against them, too. They're running out of time, and we all know what that's like. We all know what it's like to hit your 30s and then your 40s, and next thing you know, you're 50, and, you know. It's just an interesting thing that how can we bring that back, the beauty of that, the joy of it, the satisfaction of it, of great relationships, you know, and and actually, you know, show that to our children. I hope that happens more and more as we go on, that the glory, the beauty of family life is upheld and just
mm-hmm.
celebrated more and more. And you mentioned Angie and May. You know, that's interesting to me because Isadora made a comment on the board about arranged marriages. Sometimes, you know, this weird, she said, and because of this weird idea of Hollywood and Hollywood ideas of quote-unquote romantic love, but one reason why arranged marriages might work, they don't start out with some weird idea that they have to be, you know, so in lust with one another, you know. There's more of a realistic point of view. But in Angie's experience and in May's experience, both of them married somebody who bucked that tradition, that Indian tradition of arranged marriages. And that was in itself kind of a challenge. That presented challenges in itself.
Oh, yeah.
That these two wonderful young men went out and found two wonderful young women who are very much their equal and very much their partners. And it'll
mm-hmm.
be interesting to see how that evolves. I'm sure Chuck finds that so too. Mixed cultural marriages have their own challenges.
Yeah, he was there
huh?
with his parents.
They do.
Working on an arranged marriage when he met Angie.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It took
and
a lot
one of the
of
things.
Overcoming.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that May faced, May and Shankar faced, was his family saying, you know, well, all of the friends and relatives were saying, what about Shankar? When will Shankar be available? And, you know, they wanted to be able to tell their friends and family, well, he's not, you know. And so, yeah, it's interesting things that we face on this world, interesting problems we face on your ranch,
yeah.
you know, problems that aren't real common in the universe, I'm sure. But
Well, this change in the culture toward disinterest in having children. I remember sort of a dramatic moment when, you know, when I was with Claire and our kids were little. And I don't know, we'd both been to a party or something, and there were, you know, people we knew there and people I knew. And there was this one couple, and they were talking about, boy, they sure were glad they didn't have kids because they're free to travel. They could do all these things together. You know, it's uncomplicated. They don't have to worry about having kids around, driving around with Angie in her little car seat, you know, in the back seat of the car. And I don't know, we were driving, stopped at a light or something, and she made some kind of noise or put a sound. And I just turned around and looked at her, and she just smiled at me, you know, with this smile. It just melted my heart. And I just couldn't help but think about these friends who were talking about how glad they were they didn't have kids. And they had no idea, no idea what they were giving up.
Yeah.
You know, just that one smile made it all worth it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you know what I'm talking about there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's so many moments like that.
Yeah.
Well,
anyway.
What a great conversation, you guys. Thank you. That was a wonderful little distraction there on to go from those seraphic pairs to our very human and real pairs and
mm-hmm.
how it makes a difference on this world and on every world to be paired with somebody that you can trust. And that was the other point I wanted to make too, Andre, is that this army of angels works because somebody in charge is trustworthy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the story of the rebellion that happened. Somebody in charge was not trustworthy, and we've seen all too well what can happen when that, you know, with armies and all, you know, I mean, they make themselves subservient, obviously. They line up, and they make themselves subservient to a commander, and that can be a real bad situation if, as Jesus said, the blind lead the blind. But it all works marvelously because of trust, let me just say that, and because of being trustworthy. So, yeah, let's go on. Pam is saying, let's read. So, okay.
Yeah, cherubim and Samuel.
Before we read it, can I just point out one last thing before we read on? I just wanted to underscore that comment they make in the last paragraph of the previous section where they say those serving under the direct supervision of the infinite spirit as personalized on Salvington. You know, I mentioned it while I was reading it, but I think that's a really interesting description of the local universe mother spirit, that she actually is a personalization of the infinite spirit. And that's a third source personality thing. I mean, we wouldn't speak of Michael that way. You know, he's not a personalization of the Father and the Son. He's his own person, right? He's a distinct individual personality like we are, because we're all first source personalities. Whereas the Mother Spirit is in this other kind of category, which is really interesting, I think. So I just wanted to point that out.
That is interesting.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
A good thought to keep in mind. And because it's interesting when you come to sort that out and really understand what they're getting at there. Yeah, she is the mother
in
Salvington.
She is she's the creator of the seraphim, at least within the local universe. So she's their creator, and they say they're under her direct supervision. So that all makes sense. But then they point out that since the soul of Michael on your answer, now being a master son, that he is they're also subject to his sovereignty.
Well, right, but I want to also point out that he also said he has seen me as seen the Father. And he and the Father are one. You know, I mean, they, you know, maybe they get arrived at that in a different way, but they are one.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're distinctly different personalities, though.
But they are distinctly different, right? So that's the interesting part.
Well, I think we can direct our audience, if they want to, get a little more insight into what Chuck is talking about. I know that Chuck is well aware of Paper 17, Section 6, the mm-hmm. Local Universe Creative Spirits, and that gives some insight into that differentiation where, in fact, mm-hmm. really the initial paradise differentiation is virtually, literally, almost like a piece of the infinite spirit being mm-hmm. pulled
yeah.
away. And then, you know, there are slight changes that happen, but those changes happen, you know, over long, long periods of time. And
right.
it's really like a piece of the infinite spirit is becoming the consort of the Creator Son. And that almost molds itself to the needs of the Creator Son and the needs of the super universe, becomes imbued with the Master Spirit and all of that. It is a fascinating study, but it is mm-hmm. a little off from where we're going.
Right.
Paper 17, though.
But
right.
But that comment yeah. is a big hint. You know, just.
But I think that's why they make that comment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that
yeah.
comment, it harkens to that exactly. So it's good of you
right.
to point that out. I think that struck me as well. It's an interesting comment. They're really trying to get us to know our Creative Mother Spirit for what she is. And she is very literally a personification of the Infinite Spirit to our local universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Paul,
okay,
you want to read Cherubim and Sanubim?
Sure.
Yeah, let's go on.
I'll read about Cherubim and Sanubim, Section 7, Paper 38. In all essential endowments, Cherubim and Sanubim are similar to Seraphim. They have the same origin, but not always the same destiny. They are wonderfully intelligent, marvelously efficient, touchingly affectionate, and almost human. They are the lowest order of angels, hence all the nearer of kin to the more progressive types of human beings on the evolutionary worlds. Cherubim and Sanubim are inherently associated, functionally united. One is an energy positive personality, the other energy negative. The right-hand deflector, or positively charged angel, is the cherubim, the senior or controlling personality. The left-hand deflector, or negatively charged angel, is the sanubim, the complement of being. Each type of angel is very limited in solitary function. Hence, they usually serve in pairs. When serving independently of their seraphic directors, they are more than ever dependent on mutual contact and always function together. Cherubim and Sanubim are the faithful and efficient aids of the seraphic ministers, and all seven orders of Seraphim are provided with these subordinate assistants. Cherubim and Sanubim serve for ages in these capacities. They do not accompany Seraphim on assignments beyond the confines of the local universe. Cherubim and Sanubim are the routine spirit workers on the individual worlds of the systems. On a non-personal assignment and in an emergency, they may serve in the place of a seraphic pair. They never function, even temporarily, as attending angels to human beings. That is an exclusive seraphic privilege. Assigned to a planet, cherubim enter the local courses of training, including a study of planetary usages and languages. Ministering spirits of time are all bilingual, speaking the language of the local universe of their origin and that of their native super universe. A study in the schools of the realms, they acquire additional tongues. Cherubim and Sanubim, like Seraphim and all other orders of spirit beings, are continuously engaged in efforts at self-improvement. only such as the subordinate beings of power, control, and energy direction are incapable of progression. All creatures having actual or potential personality volition seek new achievements. Cherubim and Sanubim are by nature very near the Marantia level of existence, proved to be most efficient in the borderland work of the physical, Marantial, and spiritual domains. These children of the local universe mother spirit are characterized by, quote, fourth creatures, unquote, much as they are the Havona servitals and the conciliating commissions. Every fourth cherubim and every fourth sanubim are quasi-material, very definitely resembling the Marantia level of existence. These angelic fourth creatures are of great assistance to the seraphim in the more literal phases of their universe and planetary activities. Such Marantia cherubim also perform many indispensable borderline tasks on the Marantia training worlds and are assigned to the service of the Marantia companions in large numbers. They are to the Marantia spheres about what the midway creatures are to the evolutionary planets. On the inhabited world, these Marantia cherubim frequently work in liaison with the midway creatures. Cherubim and midway creatures are distinctly separate orders of beings. They have dissimilar origins, but they disclose great similarity in nature and function. A little story about the cherubim and sanubim. I love it. How indispensable they are.
Yeah, you think about those fourth creatures, that's quite a interesting variation. It's sort of apparently designed in to the plan for their, you know, servicing their services in the universe. But I'm comforted by the idea, you know, we lost so many secondary midwares to the rebellion. And they are the secondary midwares, the ones who can make contact with physical reality. So I think what they're suggesting here is that that loss, to some extent, is made up by these fourth creatures, by these Marantia cherubim, who, if I'm not mistaken, can also make contact with material reality. I mean, they're referred to as quasi-material. So, every fourth sanubim is quasi-material. So anyway.
So more akin to the Marantia, more akin to Marantia creatures.
Even though not akin by creation to the secondary midwares, there's a lot of overlap in functional potential. It sounds like so and that's what leads me to think that in large measure they can make up for the loss of secondary midwares that we experienced.
That's a good point, Chuck.
Yeah,
I never thought about that, but that's a very good point. John on the board had a question, too, and I'll just throw this out there. So they're talking about the Creator Son and the Mother Spirit still. So John said, doesn't the UB say they're one when acting as a trinity, or they collaborate together for something? Otherwise, they're distinct, correct? And then he says, I was referring to the Father and Son of the Trinity. But again, my UB understanding is that the universal Son and Daughter are distinct but work together, perhaps unified in some functional way. Yeah.
Complementary.
That is a...
They're complementary.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there you go. They're complemental. And in ways that we can't probably understand, but...
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, it's that complemental difference that enables super additive outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you combine two things that are the same, you get more of the same. If you combine two things that are complemental,
well, not,
you
not
get
entirely,
new things that nobody could have ever even
exactly
imagined.
The same.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Though, as a principle.
I do know what you mean. I know what you mean.
But, you know,
right.
That's a simple way to say you get two things that are the same, you get more of the same. That's, you know, it's interesting that we are so preoccupied with finding people that totally agree with us, because for that very reason that you get more of the same. It may be comfortable on some level, but
yeah,
you end up with more of the same. And I was
really
struck, though.
Yeah,
we have to challenge ourselves, and that they spoke to that,
yeah,
didn't they? That all spiritual beings challenge themselves to be better. I just thought that was, you know, they're speaking to progress being the watchword of the universe, right? That we need to challenge ourselves to be better.
Mm-hmm.
On all levels.
What I was going to say. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, just to complete my other thought, what I was going to say is that complemental relationships are more challenging in unique ways. So that's,
mm-hmm,
but that's part of the attraction of that as well.
And maybe,
part
of the problem comes in if they become antagonistic and competitive, you know, that is,
mm-hmm,
not helpful. But if they,
mm-hmm,
are challenging, that could be very helpful, is very helpful to challenge each other.
Right.
You know, but if, as long as there's no antagonism or competitive, antagonism.
Yeah. Well, those,
like,
yeah,
I'm better than you.
Complimentary.
Yeah.
Right. So it's helpful to have an understanding of the value of complemental relationship, and the marriage and family life papers, they really go a long way toward inspiring us to see how there's value in that. Even though, you know, like the personality gulf they refer to between men and women can be so difficult,
right,
sometimes, the overcoming of that creates potentials that wouldn't exist any other way. So having an appreciation of that, I think, can help to mitigate the whatever they say, personally antagonistic features of those relationships. You know, that you see there's a higher value in play, so you work through it, or you work with it in whatever way you can to get to those higher possibilities, which can't be achieved any other way. So.
Yeah, well, it really explains then why it's so important for especially the sexes, because I guess we're naturally complemental. Whether we're,
mm-hmm,
aggressive or retiring, whether we're introverted or extroverted, whatever the compliment is, that we don't tyrannize each other. And why they say that
yeah,
they make this comment in paper 49. We do not, this is 49.4.4, I'll just read this part of this paragraph. It says, we do not regard a planet as having emerged from barbarism so long as one,
mm-hmm,
sex seeks to tyrannize over the other. This,
mm-hmm,
feature of creature experience is always greatly improved after the arrival of a material son and daughter. There you go, guys on the board, you were saying
right,
that earlier. And it's so true. You can imagine what pandemonium would ensue if these wonderful pairs of angels began to tyrannize over each other. It just would not,
yeah,
work. And that's why they don't even consider a planet as having emerged from barbarism until that stops happening.
Yeah.
And would you say that, yeah, well, I guess I say it. Prior to the arrival of a planetary Adam and Eve, that's more pronounced on a planet than sex or another will tyrannize. But after that, it's not. So that,
mm-hmm,
kind of speaks to one of our great challenges on this world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well,
we're retarded in that regard for sure. There's no question,
yeah,
about that. You know, it's we did not get all of that. I mean, usually that is functioning reasonably well by the time the Adam and Eve come, because
right. There's
been 300,000 to 500,000 years or more of experience with the corporeal members, who those 50 couples, you know, are great exemplars of what it's like for male and female to function together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the corporeal staff or
the so that has an influence on culture as well.
Yeah, even though it wouldn't necessarily be reproducing. They still had homes, you know, they bring in the orphans and act as parents. So there's that was probably our first example of how that can work. It occurred outside of the normal evolutionary process.
Pam on the board says, tyranny is the absence of a love-dominated heart. Interesting, that word tyrannize shows up only once in the book, and that's where it shows up. Tyranny maybe shows up more, I don't know, but tyrannize shows up just the once in that paragraph on paper 49.
Yeah.
You know, guys, I wonder if we shouldn't go ahead and read the evolution of cherubim and cherubim since we were on them.
Yeah, let's do that.
And then,
absolutely.
That'll save midway creatures for last. And they're such a hard topic that. Okay, cool. Well, Andre, do you want to read that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Let me bring you up. Where are you there? Okay.
Great. Yeah.
Evolution of cherubim and cherubim. Numerous avenues of advancing service are open to cherubim and cherubim, leading to an enhancement of status, which may be still further augmented by the embrace of the divine minister. There are three great classes of cherubim and cherubim with regard to evolutionary potential. One, ascension candidates. These beings are by nature candidates for seraphic status. Cherubim and cherubim of this order are brilliant, though not by inherent endowment equal to the seraphim, but by application and experience, it is possible for them to attain full seraphic standing. Two, mid-phase cherubim. All cherubim and cherubim are not equal in ascension potential, and these are the inherently limited beings of the angelic creations. Most of them will remain cherubim and cherubim, although the more gifted individuals may achieve limited seraphic service. Three, Marantia cherubim. These fourth creatures of the angelic orders always retain their quasi-material characteristics. They will continue as cherubim and cherubim, together with a majority of their mid-phase brethren, pending the complete factualization of the Supreme Being. While the second and third groups are somewhat limited in growth potential, the ascension candidates may attain the heights of universal seraphic service. Many of the more experienced of these cherubim are attached to the seraphic guardians of destiny and are thus placed in direct line for advancement to the status of mansion world teachers when deserted by their seraphic seniors. Guardians of destiny do not have cherubim and cherubim as helpers when their mortal wards attain the Marantia life, and when other types of evolutionary seraphim are granted clearance for seraphington and paradise. They must forsake their former subordinates when they pass out of the confines of Nebadon. Such deserted cherubim and cherubim are usually embraced by the universe mother spirit, thus achieving a level equivalent to that of a mansion world teacher in the attainment of seraphic status. When, as mansion world teachers, the once embraced cherubim and cherubim have long served on the Marantia spheres, from the lowest to the highest, and when their core in Salvington is over-recruited, the bright and morning star summons these faithful servants of the creatures of time to appear in his presence. The oath of personality transformation is administered, and thereupon, in groups of 7,000, these advanced and senior cherubim and cherubim are re-embraced by the universe mother spirit. From this second embrace, they emerge as full-fledged seraphim. Henceforth, the full and complete career of a seraphim, with all its paradise possibilities, is open to such reborn cherubim and seraphim. Such angels may be assigned as guardians of destiny to some mortal being. And if the mortal ward attains survival, then do they become eligible for advancement to seraphington and the seven circles of seraphic attainment, even to the paradise and the even to paradise and the core of finality.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, the evolution that the evolution of cherubim and seraphim. Well,
so
that last
one of the
paragraph
interesting features. Yeah, one of the interesting features here that's the subtext for all of this is this idea of interposing a certain reality of the function of dominants and recessives in spiritual traits being passed on in the universe, that somehow there is some feature of how they are created that has this aspect of dominance and recessives playing in their creation. And the idea is almost this, that the ascension candidates would be those that inherit, and this is not a material inheritance, it's a spiritual inheritance, that they would be the dominant dominants, okay? They would be the first creatures. They don't call them first creatures, but they may as well call them first creatures since Morancha Cherubim are fourth creatures. You know, going to
that's
the Morancha Cherubim,
point.
You could consider them to be the recessive recessives. Well, what are the mid-phase cherubim? Well, they're the hybrids. They're the dominant recessives. Just like, you know, when you look at people with, say, it's an oversimplification, and I doubt if it's entirely accurate, but we can look at it anyway. I mean, we all studied Mendelevian genetics from Gregor Mendel in middle school biology, where we talked about dominants and recessives, and we understood pea plants, and there was a type of dominance and recessive where the dominant, if like say white was dominant and pink was recessive, then even in the hybrids, they would appear all to be, you know, white tea plants, right? If that was a dominant trait.
Mm-hmm.
And only the recessives, the fourth creatures, the one-fourth of those pea plants, would be pink, right? And the same kind of thing is happening here. Although there seems to be the idea, actually I should have used the color red on that. So think about red. There is a mixed inheritance that happens with some kinds of plants where you would have one-fourth of them being all white because they were dominant, two-fourths or one-half of all of them being pink because they would exhibit the mixed inheritance, and one-fourth that would be all red because they were fourth creatures or the recessive recessives. And that's being shown here. That's why the ascension candidates undoubtedly have that kind of potential, is they're the dominant dominants here, just like the Morancha Cherubim or the recessive recessives.
So interesting. So, yeah, we always tend to, I don't know, think about, oh, gee, those poor cherubim who never get to evolve or whatever. But that's not necessarily true, and they don't think of it that way.
Yeah.
But
there's an interesting comment. Oh, sorry, we finished. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say something about the last two paragraphs of that section really grabbed my heart.
Yeah.
And I don't know why necessarily, but you know, that their abandonment, use the word abandoned. Like, oh my gosh, that's sad. You know? And I can only imagine how that must feel to them. But then they're embraced, and they become Mansion World teachers. And then they can actually go on and achieve the core of paradise. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It ends on such a high note, right?
Right, right. Well, the implication is that our guardian seraphim, or when we have them, whenever that happens, could be former cherubim. And what a wealth of experience that would bring to that.
Maybe that's why it grabbed my heart. Maybe they're trying to tell me something.
Yeah. That's a fascinating thing to consider.
That occurred to me, Chuck. It really did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I've thought about with these abandoned cherubim who end up functioning as Mansion World teachers is that the ones from Urantia, depending on when they were abandoned, so to speak, would have full knowledge of what life was like on this world at the time they're, you know, the mortal that they were attending ascended. So if you had, you know, a seraphic pair operating as guardian seraphim for somebody from the 14th century, let's say, and then they make it to the mansion world and their seraphim, you know, their cherubim rather are abandoned to work as mansion world teachers, they would be fully knowledgeable of life on your rancher in the 14th century, right?
Mm.
And they could be wonderful instructors of history of this planet by virtue of the fact that they actually lived on this world at all these different times when their ascension candidates, you know, went on to the mansion worlds. So we're going to have this, you know, it just hit me one day when I was thinking about that, that we have this wide range of fully knowledgeable mansion world teachers who have actually experienced life on this world at all these different stages of its history, you know, with literal actual personal experience.
Breadth of experience. Yeah. Wow.
That's going to be a wonderful feature of our education, I think, is to have that kind of personal knowledge as part of, you know, our instruction. I know we're about out of time, but there's one little thing that they mentioned that I wanted to see what you guys think about this. Earlier on, when they're talking about these pairs, where did that go? I just had it. Well, they talk about the right-hand deflector. Yeah, the right-hand deflector or positive charge angel, and then they talk about the left-hand deflector or negatively charged angel is this animum. So this idea of right-hand deflector and left-hand deflector, I mean, that's very unusual language just to throw into the middle of that sentence.
That struck me too, Chuck. I got to tell you. I'm like, right-hand and left-hand?
But, you know, I can kind of relate to that. I mean, I'm personally right-handed. I don't know if you know, everybody, I don't know if you guys are. Some people are left-handed. Some are both. But, you know, majority of people, I guess, are right-handed. So if you think about it, if there's something coming at you, you're going to deflect it with your right hand, most likely. But if that doesn't work, then you'll add your left hand. but the difference in hand, you know, the difference in how the right hand feels versus the left hand, if you're right-handed, I don't know, maybe gives us some sense of what they're talking about there. I mean, in a way,
when it's dominant, right? That's what
between our dominant and recessive hands. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We do things with our left hand that we don't do with our right hand. We do things with our right hand we don't do with our left hand. So there might be a pattern there. That's
there is. I think you're right, Chuck. One is always kind of the stabilizer, and the other one is the action-oriented, you know, the one that is the thrust, the strength, but the other one is stabilizing. That's interesting.
And maybe more receiving also.
Right. Wow. Well, what a great conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting
guys
to use the
angels.
Word deflection.
Deflection, that was an interesting use of
ponder that some more. But.
I'm looking at chess, right? A tactic that forces an opposing chess piece to leave a square, you know, or deflection in ballistics, shooting ahead of a moving target so that the target and projectile will collide. That's another use of the word deflection. The displacement of a structural element under load. The event where an object collides and bounces against a plane surface. As in, you know, like when you're playing pool, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can develop whole strategies. You know, then how this ball's going to hit that ball and then how that's going to deflect in some other direction and get your target in the pocket.
I'm not sure I'm understanding, you know, their use of deflection there, but they're using it for a reason to try to get us to maybe understand that there's a real technicality here, that there's that it is almost like physics in deflection.
So they also talk about their energy charge. And that's associated with an energy charge, which is also interesting in its own, you know. What they mean by that is also a question.
Well, that's food for thought, friends. And Pam on the board says that she quotes, but when you give to the poor, do not let your right hand, your left hand know what your right hand is doing. So how does that fit in with deflection and
that's a new wrinkle there, Pam. More to think about, more to chew on.
You know, what a great conversation, you guys. Thank you so much. I love just, there's no, how can you go wrong when you're contemplating angels? I just don't know how you could go wrong with that. And it's so rewarding and fantastic. One of the things that I have loved for so long about the Urantia book is exactly that. The way it tells us and teaches us about angels, nothing comes close to the Urantia book on angels what they do and how they operate and who they are and the myriad of ways they serve is just beyond gratifying to me. And so next time we'll be talking about midwayers, and they are fascinating creatures. So that's going to be fun. And there's lots of cross-references to be had on that. And that's the last section of this paper. And then it has been suggested that we might start with paper one, the Universal Father. So, and we have a couple of people who would like to be guests on the show, too, the daughters of Le Ru Tiao. Beautiful Hawaiian and Mormon Urantia book reader who has done many, many beautiful works on YouTube under the moniker Urantian Artist, all one word. So if you want to look up Le Ruth's works, Le Ruth graduated a few years back, but her daughters are both readers, and they would love to come on and talk about their beautiful mother and about Mormonism and the Urantia book. So that would be a really neat show. And Sharon Adams would love to join us in that. And she's also with LDS and a Urantia book reader. So that'll be interesting. But we'll think about paper one, the Universal Father, to start with. And because Robert said he thought that would be a great idea to start the new year with that.
Yeah.
And if
what about paper 39? We're not going to do 39.
Well, I'm open to it. We can come back to it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay.
We'll
jumping right into paper
next
one
next week. Yeah, we can make that decision if we decide to do a little bit more on angels before we go on. But Happy New Year, everyone.
So, Happy New Year. Thank you. It was a treat. We love you all. Appreciate you. And we'll be back next week with another edition of The Cosmic Citizen. Yeah, me too, Chuck. Thank you, my dear friends.
Thank you.
Love you.
Bye for now. See you in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Yep. See you next year.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.